Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Adam Koch is my name, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune are my co-hosts. Gents, wonderful to see you both again. As always, it's so hard to keep up with what's happening in the world, but let's start with the 30-day ceasefire that has been agreed on the Ukraine war. Of course, Russia invaded Ukraine more than 2 years ago now, and of course, all the other repercussions that have come from President Zelensky's visit to the White House and the incredible showdown that went down between him, Trump, and US Vice President J.D. Vance. Saudi Arabia talks happened over the last couple of days. A 30-day ceasefire has been agreed to. Rodney, take us through, what does this all mean?
Well, it means, in short, that we're all waiting to see how Russia respond to this. I mean, they responded militarily shortly after the agreement with an attack on Kiev. But are they going to bite with this opportunity to agree a ceasefire to open up the space for discussions? On some military analysts' perspective, they're suggesting that logistics chains are quite stretched in Russia at the minute. There's been a massive drop off in the number of ground attacks and the quality or the effectiveness of those attacks, and therefore Russia is in great need of breathing space. From the Ukrainian point of view, now they've decided to say what the Americans wanted them to do in the first place, one presumes, as well as the mineral deal. The Americans have turned on the tap of intelligence and some military support again, which was switched off after the Oval Office debacle. But again, there's no indication or no clarity that there is an expectation that Moscow's going to respond in kind to this offer or potential of a ceasefire. And if it does happen, it opens up the space for talks. Of course, the big discussion points then will be Russia's previous breaches of ceasefire agreements, which have been frequent, and there's a low expectation that they would keep any agreement. As well as giving them the space to rearm, rebuild, and revisit the war in Ukraine. And again, any ceasefire stroke, prolonged ceasefire stroke settlement may not provide the type of protection for Ukraine as many Europeans and Ukrainians would like to see. So it's all very fluid. It's not clear where this is going to settle, but the first next stage is what Moscow says in response.
So it's an interesting contrast to where we were a week ago when obviously President Zelensky's now infamous sort of showdown with Trump and J.D. Vance in the Oval Office led to Trump effectively kicking him out of the White House and saying, come back when you want a peace deal. So much of the picture has been painted as if Ukraine is not the country that has wanted peace. Ozan, what cards does Trump have now to effectively persuade Russian President Vladimir Putin to take up this ceasefire, and what implications do you see in sort of the next stage of the negotiations that now need to happen?
I think it's very interesting because this ceasefire was very much pushed forward by Ukraine, and there are no terms attached to it. So as many of our listeners would know, in the last few weeks, we've been talking about a number of conditions attached to a peace deal that the US was trying to broker, which included minerals deals and various mining provisions for the US, etc. But this ceasefire seems to be very much pushed by Ukraine, and it's something that in some ways is a win for them, because they don't have to give up any of the kind of terms. They don't have to give up anything from that point of view. In some sense, it's a win for Marco Rubio, because I understand that he's been pretty active in organizing or brokering this deal. So it's very interesting. It comes on the back of probably, and I'm not sure how accurate this is, but this is what has been mentioned on social media, that on the back of the biggest attack on Moscow since World War II. And for those of our listeners who are not aware, on the eve of agreeing to this ceasefire, Ukraine undertook a very significant drone attack on Moscow, and it was one of the biggest, well, certainly since the war has started between Ukraine and Russia, very, very significant attack. So it comes on the back of that, and I think it's, if you ask me, I think it's a win for Zelensky because he gets to have a ceasefire, probably some space there to negotiate some sort of long-lasting peace deal with Putin. But of course, the most important thing here is whether Putin will respect this ceasefire. And critics of Putin have mentioned that he's not interested in a ceasefire without specific terms, particularly around the land. And of course, from the US's perspective, around some of the minerals deals that President Trump has put forward. So it will be very interesting to see. Look, I hope that the ceasefire lasts for a month, and we can have some sort of negotiation for a long-lasting peace deal that of course the Ukrainians, the Europeans, the Americans, and the Russians are all involved in.
It's really interesting to me. Marco Rubio said that this isn't an episode of Mean Girls, right? That was sort of something that he came up with, saying, you know, we're here, we're serious, we're at the table, we're having these negotiations, we're having these peace talks. We expect this to be, you know, upheld by the Russians and taken. But I mean, to me, the politics of how this has all been played out is actually an episode from Mean Girls. If you think about what happened in the Oval Office and has reverberated through podcasts and news discussions and commentaries and media analysis since, and now suddenly there's this offer on the table that you know, as we say, looks more like a win for Ukraine than anybody else. I mean, this sort of on again, off again, here's how we view the Ukraine war. No, Zelensky doesn't want peace. Well, actually he does, because he's come to the table with 30 days and now it's up to Russia. I mean, this chaotic sort of way of approaching foreign policy, and we're going to get to domestics as well in a moment. How does that sort of sit, Rodney? I mean, how does the world try to make sense of it all when in this particular situation with the Russia-Ukraine war, it's going to translate into whether lives are continually lost or not? I mean, what's your sort of take on all of that?
I mean, we've just got a bunker down for 4 years of chaos, with Trump's leadership and his leadership team, it feels like, because inconsistency is the only point of consistency with the government, whether it be on-off tariffs, whether it be build a wall, don't finish the wall, whether it be domestic policy decisions or foreign policy decisions. The ability to flip shamelessly is one of Trump's greatest performance tactics. So it's really difficult for others to know how to react to all these threats and the on-off stuff, whether it be in the foreign policy sphere of Ukraine or indeed with tariffs and so on. But it certainly doesn't make America any friends, and it does damage America's standing with long-term allies, and it's not good for America in the long term, irrespective of who succeeds Trump, because those relationships, once they're broken and other relationships are established and replace those ties with America, it's not going to just switch back overnight. It's going to have to be something which is going to have to be restored over a longer period of time. So I would say medium long term, this isn't good for America. It's short term, it's certainly not good for other world leaders in knowing how to avoid being drawn into the Trump circus, but still manage damage limitation in terms of their own positioning and their own economic policy.
I think the important thing here is that, Trump ran on a platform of promising to sort out the Russia-Ukraine war in 24 hours. Obviously, most of us knew that that was not possible. But what this, I think, does is It gives Ukraine some cards to play with. It puts Ukraine in a bit more of a position where they are controlling the narrative, they are controlling the whole peace process. And I have to be honest with you, it's not great for President Trump because it was very obvious from the White House conversation that he had with Zelensky and the vice president, etc., that he was very keen on signing a deal, and no deal's been signed. This ceasefire has no terms attached to it, and it looks a little bit like the president hasn't been able to achieve what he has wanted to achieve. So, if you ask me politically, this is a little bit of a kick in the guts for President Trump.
But I mean, he did the same with the Israel-Hamas situation, didn't he? I mean, he said, Hamas has 24 hours, whatever it was, till the weekend to return the hostages, otherwise all hell would break loose. And, well, none of those two things happened. Hamas didn't release all the hostages. All hell did not break loose. Arguably, hell has been
It
breaking.
did in the Oval Office, Erdem. It didn't say where it was going to break loose. I agree with you, but it did in the Oval Office.
The wrong foreign leader.
Yeah, sorry.
but there was an interesting piece in the New York Times arguing that for so many analysts, they looked at Trump 2.0 as what would largely mirror his first term. When you have a look at, the 50 days or so that he's been in power, like the things that he has done and the chaos that has been created, it's really hard to keep up. And no, none more obvious than that was, of course, the tariffs that was implemented against three major trading partners of the US. It was initially 25%. Part of that went up to 50% with the Canadians. It was sort of off, it was on, now it's back on. Countries like Australia wanted an exemption. He said he'd consider it. Then he sort of, he said, no, we won't. The question was put to him by reporters this week. Well, does this signal, obviously there's price increases when tariffs happen. It's kind of the point of it. Does it mean that the US could go into recession? He stumbled on that answer. He said that he doesn't like to predict these things. People took that as, yes, the US will go into recession. The stock market dipped to levels that we haven't seen in a very long time amid fears of a US recession. I mean, economically, things aren't looking that great either. How does this translate into the politics of how Trump and his team play this and how the American people and indeed the world sort of deal with it?
Look, I'm happy to jump in here. I honestly believe that Trump is in a bit of trouble when it comes to the economics of his agenda. And I say this because he got elected by and large through a protest vote in some sense against the economic conditions. Everybody was very, very upset with the way that the economy was going, cost of living, inflation, all of these sorts of things. And he made promises around things like egg prices and many other things around the cost of living that he would fix these from the first day in office. And of course, I don't want to be partisan here, but I think when it comes to egg prices, they're at record levels, record high levels. And of course, we can't blame that fully on President Trump. But at the end of the day, the Republican Party and President Trump effectively made the last election about egg prices and various other indicators of cost of living. This is what they made the last election about. So on those fronts, I think he's really struggling. And look, all you have to do is look at the State of the Union, which wasn't a State of the Union. I'm not sure what it's called, but his speech to the joint session of the Congress. He spent a lot of time on a lot of things, if you ask me, that helped him from a political point of view with his base, and that's that's all okay. However, he spent very little time talking about what he's going to do about the cost of living, and he's spent very little time about what he's going to do about generating economic growth, all of these sorts of things. at some point in time, people are going to question why he's concerned about many of the things that he's concerned about. For example, making Greenland rich. I mean, for the benefit of our listeners, he made several comments in the last week around how he wants to take over Greenland and invest in Greenland and make them very rich. But you're going to have serious kind of concerns amongst the populace and amongst the electorate around where his focus areas are. He's spending a lot of time focusing on the things that are not the things that people elected him to fix. And I think that's something that is going to be a big political problem for him. To add to that, I think, it's many people are starting to wonder why he is going out of his way to tank the economy with a lot of these on and off tariffs. The stock market is not going great. And of course, as we know from his first term, the stock market was a big reference point for his kind of definition of success. These are things that I think are starting to, or will start to come back to haunt him. And he doesn't have a lot of answers for these. And I think what he's trying to do, and what certainly what his cabinet members are trying to do, is to kind of give this impression that we need to go through these very hard times. His Treasury Secretary mentioned that we need to detox from the Biden economics era. We need to go through these tough times so that we can prosper in the future. And I'm not sure how convincing that is. I think that's something that many of the people that voted for him in the hope that he would fix up some of these economic issues are not going to really to agree with, particularly coming from, someone like him, who's an alleged, well, supposedly he's a billionaire, and then other people who are very active in his administration, such as Elon Musk, who is reportedly the richest man in the world. When these people tell you that we need to just persevere, go through some tough times economically, because at the there is light at the end of the tunnel. And on the other side, we're going to have a very prosperous economic kind of conditions. I'm not sure how that's going to kind of play for him politically.
Look, his approval ratings are starting to indicate the potential for a downward turn, but I don't think any of these things are hurting him as much yet as they should in your objective analysis. I still don't see that it's getting the same cut through, but potentially we're starting to see a little bit more of that with stock market, but it remains to be seen. He seems to be quite resilient when it comes to things he should be blamed for not getting attached to him, which is another one of Trump's skills, but we'll see how long that lasts.
Well, I mean, of course, everything is Biden's fault. I mean, he is talking about a imminent recession, but obviously that's not his fault. It's a kind of, carryover from the Biden days, and it's the Biden recession, etc. So, I completely agree with you. I think he's a master at telling this story, and putting forward this narrative. But look, it's really up to others to challenge him on that, because I think one of the very important things that we need to keep in mind is that the minute that President Biden took office in 2021, January 20th, he got blamed for a lot of things that, at the end of the day, were a carryover from the Trump administration. Trump himself, along with very much the right-wing media ecosystem, have created this I suppose have rewritten the rules around all of this stuff, that if you're the president, you're in charge of or you're responsible for egg prices, you're responsible for a whole bunch of things that in the past most people would have given, a kind of pass to most of the presidents who were in charge around some of these things. But, the right wing media and the far right media kind of ecosystem has created this scenario. And, and Trump has created this whole narrative around the president's responsible for egg prices. And let's face it, the egg prices of right now are the highest they've ever been. So he's going to face some problems, I think, from an economic point of view. Not to mention that if you have a look at some of what the experts are saying, I think a few of the banks have upgraded their kind of projections around an election. I think JP Morgan Chase has increased their projection of a chance of a recession from 30 to 40% in the next 12 months. And I think Goldman Sachs has also increased their projection of the chance of a recession. So yeah, things are looking a little bit difficult from an economic point of view. Now, the argument is he trying to tank the economy on purpose to try and do a whole bunch of things that we're not kind of across? I'm not sure. This is something that is being put forward by many commentators, but I'm really not sure that we're playing, four-dimensional or five-dimensional chess here. I think that his back and forth on the tariffs, his inability to kind of grasp basic economic kind of policies, etc., are giving people a sense of uncertainty and a concern. And I think, we're seeing significant decreases in business and consumer sentiment. So I think these things are, at the end of the day, are creeping into the whole debate.
I just want to pick up on one thing there, Ozan, is you mentioned, that people need to hold him to account and ask the right questions and pick him up on things that, the claims that he's making or whatever, and present alternative policies. I mean, I've asked this question before, but what is the play here that the Democrats are doing? You've advised a lot of politicians and a lot of political parties and continue to do so. Is it a game of where they're saying, sometimes you do just let your opponent stuff up and, let them make the mistakes and then you come in sort of later on? Is that what they're doing? Or is it a case of, this inability to articulate sort of, messaging and thoughts? We saw the behavior of the Democrats in the State of the Union and, where they're holding up cards and one of the Democrats sort of yelled up and ejected. I mean, it's one thing not standing and applauding a US president, which both sides of politics does. That's what politics is. When Biden does his State of the Union address, we don't have the Republicans standing up and applauding him. But it's one thing to behave in a way which, to me, doesn't really help advance your cause. When you think of the great Williams F1 racing team and the CEO at the time always constantly saying to his team, does it make the car go faster? Like, everything has to make the car go faster. Everything for the Democrats has to advance the cause. We're seeing, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who's by all sort of analysis will likely be running for president in 3 4 years' time on the Democratic ticket. He's launched his own podcast now. He held Charlie Kirk, a very prominent Republican, and a young guy who sort of, goes to universities and talks with young people and has been part of this incredible swing by the young vote and the youth vote towards the Republicans. And, I mean, you sort of, Charlie just destroys the governor with facts and passion and articulate responses. And I mean, again, like, what are the Democrats doing? Why are they not doing the things that you just outlined needs to be done to counter the Trump rhetoric?
I think at the end of the day, it was a bit cringe to watch some of the Democrats putting up those signs during the State of the Union. I think Al Green interrupting the president during his speech, etc. There's a place for that, but in 2 years' time, when we have the midterms, nobody's going to remember that. I don't think that really makes a big impact. I think what some of the Democrats are doing, in terms of going to some of those very, very Republican congressional seats and doing town halls, I think that sort of stuff makes a big impact. I personally believe that I don't think the Democrats have figured out what the actual, the formula is to oppose Trump 2.0. I think, James Carville, who most people would know as one of the architects of the kind of Clinton era and a very, very well-known Democratic strategist. His view right now is that the Democrats should just sit back and allow Trump to destroy himself. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think, and again, it's he's a pretty credible guy. But I don't. I'm not sure I agree with that type of mentality. I think you've got to get out there and, you've got to hit on the things that people care about, and that is the cost of living. That is the basic issues that people effectively fled from the Democratic Party and cast their votes for Trump. Those sorts of issues that they wanted Trump to address, he's not addressing. And those are the sorts of things that you've got to really push on. And, there have been some very interesting rallies that have been held by Bernie Sanders, and other Democrats as well, as I mentioned, in very red states, very Republican states, and Republican congressional areas. And I think that's what you've got to do. You've got to let people know that the Democrats are about them. This comes back to what, if you ask me, one of the most effective ads that Trump ran around during the campaign in 2024, and that was around, he, she, they, etc. The Democrats are about them, and Trump is about you. And you've got to switch that back, and you've got to let people know that actually, Trump has sold you a lemon. He is not about you. He couldn't care less about you, and he's partnering up with Elon Musk, who's running around cutting the government and using Doge as some sort of vehicle to cut, veterans services and many other services, etc. We're actually about you. We want to protect your well-being. We want to protect your interests, etc. These are the sorts of things that they need to run on.
Yeah, look, at State of Union or the address to both houses will be forgotten very quickly. I agree 100%, Ozan. The best I've heard is that the Democrats are regrouping, but I'm going to give a shout out to Doug Ford, the Ontario Premier, who, despite his scandal-ridden brother, who you'll remember when he was Mayor of Toronto, has done more in terms of getting on the US media to critique Trump's economic policies as ones that are going to hurt Americans than anyone else so far. So perhaps he'll get some cut through with that. And maybe that is where the opposition to Trump is going to come from, and maybe galvanize a little bit the domestic political opposition to be more forceful in their critique and do a little bit more.
Well, that's the actions of one world leader. Another world leader and some interesting developments on that front is, of course, the former Filipino president, Rodrigo Duterte, who's now en route to The Hague to face trial at the International Criminal Court. Rodney, what's going on there?
The points are, one, he could have been prosecuted domestically because they're crimes in the Philippines against Philippine nationals. And the second interesting point is they left the International Criminal Court, but they've allowed them to execute a warrant in the Philippines to arrest
Yeah,
the former head
which
of
is very
state, whose
unusual.
daughter's the vice president, who is currently being impeached. This is a massive power grab, and it actually sets potential precedent for those who want to get rid of their predecessors to pass it on to the international community to deal with, and not have to get their grubby hands with, things like Imran Khan being banged up in Islamabad or whatever, when they can just send them off to The Hague and let them deal with it, and then proceed to run a similar regime that's not any cleaner than their predecessor. I think those are interesting potential precedents around this topic.
And before we go, a quick mention of the new Canadian Prime Minister. Of course, Justin Trudeau, the long-standing Prime Minister of Canada, had announced his resignation and his desire to ensure that there was a smooth transition of power from him to the next Canadian Prime Minister elected by the party. Ozan, tell us about the new Canadian PM and what we're likely to see on that front.
Yeah, look, this is a very interesting development. Obviously, Justin Trudeau had flagged his desire to leave Parliament and step down from being Prime Minister, and there was a process there from the ruling Liberal Party to elect the next Prime Minister, and former central banker Mark Carney pretty much won in a landslide. The vote of the internal Liberal Party election, he's quite an interesting character. Now, the question is when he will face an election against the Conservatives. I think the very interesting thing here is that about 3 months ago, the Conservatives in Canada looked like that they were going to demolish the ruling Liberal Party, and ever since the takeover from or ever since President Trump took office, we've been seeing, particularly through a lot of this tariff debate, we've been seeing slowly the Liberal Party increase in the polls, and they've gone from effectively being decimated to right now being very much in contention to win the next election. So if you're a conservative in Canada, you have to ask yourself that what type of favor Donald Trump has done for you, because at the end of the day, it really has a lot of this anti-Canada rhetoric coming from Donald Trump has unified the country. I think Justin Trudeau, on his way out, has had the flexibility and the ability to get the country to rally around the flag. And I suspect that now Prime Minister Carney will continue with this sort of political stance, and may very well win an election that 3 months ago looked absolutely impossible for the Liberals to win.
Interesting indeed, and let's see how Canada navigates the incredible difficulties of working with a Trump administration and what the implications will be for the rest of the world. Never a dull moment, gents. Thank you so much for your time this week. See you next. And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.